You're busy, and you want the best for your kids. We're here to help. This is Hope and Will, a parenting podcast from Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. Today, we're cutting through the confusion around type 1 diabetes, what it is, what it isn't, how it's diagnosed, and the signs every parent, teacher, and caregiver should know. We'll talk about why a missed symptom can be dangerous and how small steps toward awareness can lead to big impact on affected families. You don't need a medical degree to understand type 1, but you do need to know enough to protect and support the kids around you. You might be tuning in because you're a parent of a child with type 1 diabetes, teaching one or coaching one, or maybe your child shares a classroom, sideline, or birthday party circuit with one. Whether you're deep in this world already or just want to be a more informed adult in a child's life, this episode will give you the knowledge and the confidence to do just that. We're glad you're here. Megan, I'm going to start with you. So about a year ago, you could have been tuning into this episode as anyone who just wanted to understand type 1 diabetes a little bit better. Maybe you just wanted to be informed of how it could impact your child's classmates or kids that might attend a birthday party you were hosting. But that's no longer the case. Can you share with us how you were thrust into the world of those directly impacted by type 1 diabetes?
I would say that in our situation, it was the ultimate blind side. We had a happy, healthy, vivacious teenage daughter. She's always been a very passionate kid in terms of what she commits herself to and was a very adept musician and a leader within her high school's marching band. And we started to notice a couple of different symptoms that I think in isolation, any parent would notice, but they could easily be attributed to any number of other factors that were not urgent. As they popped up, they didn't seem particularly threatening. But as I look back, now better understanding the disease, when combined together, they absolutely were red flags for a patient that is dealing with type 1. Sarah has always been great at hydrating, but over the course of about 2 months, the increased thirst was incredibly noticeable. She would go through up to a gallon of water a day. She started to lose weight and always was a tall, thin, very strong teenage girl. She was eating great portions, very healthy quality of food. And so again, we attributed that to 12-hour training days within her marching band schedule. And she was part of the prop crew and was, you know, lifting all of these heavy things. And so we saw what she was eating and just assumed it was a temporary thing. And another symptom that presented itself over a series of weeks was that she was waking up in the morning after deep sleep and we were noticing elevated heart rates. And that just didn't add up to us because she was deep in sleep. It should be a time when the body is at rest, but a patient that has type 1 pre-diagnosis, their body never really is able to rest because it's constantly trying to kick sugar and find reserves to keep people alive and energized. And then as we approach the holidays, she's always been a healthy eater, but she was eating larger quantities of food, but didn't feel satiated. And so I'd see her snacking 10 to 15 minutes after we'd finish a four-course dinner, and that was just not at all like her. And the last thing was that she's always had a very regular cycle as a teenage girl, and she missed two cycles, which was kind of, I think, the final straw for us. So we marched ourselves into our pediatrician, and in less than 10 minutes, were being fast-tracked into the emergency room at Children's. And suffice it to say, everything in our world got thrown onto its axis, and it's been quite an incredible 9 months since then.
I guess the bigger question then becomes like sort of what is the most surprising thing that you found in this experience that you were like, I can't believe that I had no idea that this is what life was going to be like after being diagnosed.
A very strong positive is we feel truly blessed to have been walking this walk here in Atlanta. And the medical team, the diabetes educators, every hospital staff person from janitorial to RNs, there has been such a strong sense of support. And I don't know how we would have made it those first few months without that. And there's five words that they seem to always know when to say, and it's so well received as a parent and as a patient, and that's keep up the great work. I think the biggest surprise is just how unpredictable type 1 can be, because you can be the most diligent, disciplined, rule-following person, do all the correct ratios, and follow all of the perfect protocols. But your blood sugar, there's no guarantee it's going to react the same day to day. And that's been a really big hurdle for us as a family to climb, because Sarah is a type A perfectionist and she's not afraid of doing the work. No one in this family is afraid of doing the work. But you want the reward of feeling like with all the work that you're putting in, your body will respond in a favorable way and you're going to get better lab readings and your A1C is going to improve. And what worked on Sunday hopefully will work on Wednesday. And that's just not how it works. It is an all-encompassing disease. It's a disease that doesn't sleep. For the most part, yes, everybody knows someone who has type 1 diabetes, but not everybody, well, very few actually understand everything that goes on behind the scenes on a day-to-day basis. So I would say the rose in this situation is this incredible group. They're truly angels in our world of the diabetes educators. On a more negative note, I think just the general lack of understanding and awareness of the population as a whole, especially teenagers, that can be really isolating. People think that they know, but they don't really know. And in the words of my daughter, I just wish someone would ask me and not give comments like, oh, that stinks, or boy, I'm glad I'm not you.
Yeah, maybe some of the things that they could do to accommodate her rather than maybe making it a little bit more challenging, even if that's unintentional. Allison, I want to bring you in here. You're a diabetes educator at Children's. Can you talk to us a little bit about the role that you play, the path that led you to this career?
So I have had type 1 diabetes since I was 9. I was diagnosed sort of similarly to Sarah in that all of those classic symptoms, the being thirsty, the urinating a lot, all of those things led to my diagnosis. I came through Children's for diabetes education and had a really wonderful experience. And my parents, it sounds like maybe similar to Sarah's parents in that they encouraged me to keep going. They encouraged me to do whatever I wanted to do, knowing that I needed to have a healthy respect for diabetes, but that it shouldn't stop me from doing anything that I wanted to do. And so as I was coming up and going through college and grad school, realizing that I wanted to be a light in some of the people that are being diagnosed with diabetes life to provide empowerment.
You had a really incredible diagnosis story in the sense that you had gone to the doctor just 2 weeks before your diagnosis, right? Tell me about that.
So when I was diagnosed, I had a lot of the classic symptoms of type 1 diabetes. I was urinating a lot. I was drinking a lot. I was hungry. I was just not acting like myself. I had lots of weight loss and couldn't really figure out what was going on. So my mom and dad took me to my pediatrician. Essentially, it was just missed. I had an ear infection. I was 9 years old, so starting to hit adolescence, maybe puberty. So thinking that maybe some of that weight loss could even be attributed to that. And it wasn't. Sent me home with an antibiotic for my ear infection. And then as I really just became increasingly more sick, my mom actually had taken me to the pediatrician again and said, I think something is wrong. Something just doesn't feel right. And nothing's wrong. Just keep doing what you're doing. She's going to get over it. And I didn't, because it wasn't just the ear infection. So I began to what my mom used to describe as talking out of my head, which now I know is altered mental status, just being confused, not making sense, just not making a lot of sense, confusion. And overall, so tired. I was a super active kid and I only just wanted to lay down. And so my mom, when I started doing the talking out of my head, as she describes it, she said, that's it. I'm taking her to the hospital, knowing that she could feel that it was an emergency situation. So I do tell the story a lot that we drove from my house to the hospital. And by the time we got to the hospital in my hometown, there's actually a police officer chasing us with the lights on, being like, why is this lady driving like a maniac? Luckily, we got to the hospital. She did not get a ticket, but that police officer did end up actually carrying me into the hospital and saying, something's obviously wrong with this child if this woman was driving like that. Was then diagnosed, and I was very, very sick. I was actually in the ICU for almost a week and went into even cardiac arrest, but was revived, thankfully. And then after being diagnosed, I did do my diabetes education through Children's.
You hear that kids tend to be diagnosed not just with diabetes, but a lot of other conditions as well. And it can happen when there are breaks in routine, like when kids are out of school for a break or they're home for their summer. Maybe parents are less distracted by that go-go of all the weekly activities that we have, and they pick up on some of these changes. Is that true?
In some ways, I think so. I think especially for our type 2 population, that can be really true. And that you're seeing, that just doesn't seem right. I'm seeing some of these symptoms, but they're not incredibly severe. Most of the time when type 1 is diagnosed, that autoimmune response, when it goes and starts to attack the beta cells, it's usually pretty quick. So whether it is during the summertime, over the holiday break, over spring break, whatever that looks like, sometimes that can occur, but more often than not, it is a quick trigger, something's very wrong, and you know you need to get to the hospital. So knowing those signs and symptoms, I think, can be incredibly helpful.
And I bet it's so comforting to have somebody that has experienced it and is experiencing it to guide them through. And I want to talk about those signs and symptoms in just a moment. Let's bring in Dr. Nichols. I want to hear from you. Let's start with the basics. What exactly is type 1 diabetes, and how common is this?
So type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune condition in which the immune system gets activated against the pancreas that normally produces insulin. Insulin normally functions to let sugar from the blood into the cells to be used for energy. And when it can't get into the cells, it just stays high in the blood. And then it actually flows out of the kidneys and causes the water to follow it. And you lose your calories that way and you lose your water that way. Hence the weight loss and excessive appetite and excessive thirst before you're diagnosed.
And how is it different than type 2 diabetes?
Type 2 diabetes is a problem in which there is a presence of insulin and you're making insulin, but the body has become resistant to insulin. So it's seen too much insulin over time and has stopped having the same ability to respond. And so that ends in the same outcome of having blood sugar that is too high and it not entering the cells as well to be used for energy.
When it comes to type 1, how does it develop? Is it something that you can prevent? Is it genetic?
There is a component of heritability, and it's not completely understood, but there's sort of a genetic and immune makeup and risk factors. And then there's usually sort of an environmental trigger, either a virus or a stressful event, sometimes even puberty itself, that causes the immune system to turn against a part of itself. In this case, it's the pancreas. Sort of gets to the answer of, is there something that we can do to prevent it? No, the trigger cannot be prevented. The immunologic and genetic background of someone who has the risk factors for developing type 1 diabetes can't be modified. But there are new drugs where if we know that somebody has their immune system got activated against the pancreas, but they don't yet have high blood sugar, there is a new recently FDA approved medication that can be used to prevent the onset of need for insulin.
Interesting. And we talked about genetics being a factor. Is it, though, something that is a guarantee? Like if a parent has it, how much more likely is it that their child will have it? What about siblings and distant relatives?
Yeah, it's not at all a guarantee. People with a first-degree relative have a 5% risk of developing type 1 diabetes, which is about 15 times higher than the general population for developing type 1 diabetes. Like 90% of kids who are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes do not have a first-degree relative. But there is an increased risk if you have a first-degree relative, and the risk becomes even higher if you have an identical twin or something. That's the risk is 30 to 70% in someone with a twin with diabetes.
But lower than I expected.
Yeah, it's still not 100%.
So a lot of moms might have experienced gestational diabetes. So if a mom has it in pregnancy, does it mean the child will be more susceptible?
Not for type 1. So there is a known increased risk for obesity and type 2 diabetes in someone who gestated in gestational diabetes. So that's thought to be both genetic, and when you grow in an environment where there's high sugar, you overproduce insulin yourself, and that insulin resistance phenotype starts early.
We heard from Allison, she was diagnosed at 9. Is there a typical range of diagnosis? Does that even exist?
Allison was pretty typical, unfortunately. So 10 to 14 is the most common age to get diagnosed with type 1 diabetes.
Can I jump in and just make one quick comment as to the age range? It's interesting because part of that general awareness building, my daughter was the one who pointed it out. She said, "Mom, I feel like I've lost the sense of invincibility." She was a perfectly healthy child, no family history, but she got a really bad virus in late October, early November. And for whatever reason, everyone seems to think that was what flipped the switch. So I would urge parents, without being alarmist, to never be complacent.
Yeah. And you talk about the virus triggering your daughter, and we talked about some other like stressful events, environmental factors. Is that a guarantee that it will trigger the diagnosis?
There's definitely not a for sure. So I tell the story often. I was diagnosed at 9. We don't have any real reason that it happened. There was not a significant virus. I didn't have any sort of traumatic event that occurred, but I was diagnosed with diabetes at 9. My brother, who grew up in the same household as I did, we have the same parents, very similar upbringing. He was a few years older than me, 3 years older than me. He wasn't diagnosed until he was 31.
Wow.
And he went through lots of other events through high school and college. He is a veteran. He served overseas in his early 20s. And still, that wasn't a trigger for it. So we really can't know what those triggers are. We just know that there's something that tells the immune system to attack the pancreas and kill off those beta cells. You do feel safe, and then something happens and there you are. But I think knowing the symptoms, and I think speaking about it and being very aware of what diabetes can be and what we can look out for. And to Dr. Nichols' point, if we do catch it early, there are some ways that we have now that we can delay the onset of true type 1 where you are taking insulin. But at the end of the day, once the trigger is triggered, once it happens,
it's there. Right.
We're going to get there.
Yeah. Dr. Nichols, I want to get to some of the signs and symptoms that you alluded to so that we can diagnose early, because I know you say it's really important. When my son was 7-ish, he was having this extreme thirst, like insatiable extreme thirst. And that was the first time I heard about the potential for diabetes. And we did all of the testing and thankfully he was cleared. But is that something that down the road could then be triggered and it could be diabetes?
No. If you have excess thirst and it is caused by diabetes, you will have a high blood sugar. That will not, it's not hiding from you.
That's so important because I think parents hear some of the signs and symptoms and they're like, oh, wait, I think my child has experienced that.
Yeah.
What are some of those other signs and symptoms people should look for then?
I think Megan did a really beautiful job describing all of these things can seem a little benign, but taken together, they are something. So it's thirst, increased urination, and usually that shows up or people notice it the most overnight. So younger kids will wet the bed who were previously potty trained. Older kids will wet the bed. Older kids will wake up 3 times in the middle of the night to pee. People describe their kids drinking the water in the shower. It's thirst beyond what the average parent is noticing when they think that there's increased thirst. It is highly preventable for it to get to the point that it got for Allison. So I do hope that this conversation raises spidey senses, because when Allison presented the first time and the second time, she had diabetes.
And that's why there are risks in missing this. Dr. Nichols, can you lay that out for the listeners? Because that's really important. Like, you might think something is benign, but you need to have it checked out.
Yeah. And it's an easy test. It's a pee test or a finger stick and you're done. But if you really have suspicion for this for your child, take them to the pediatrician. You've taken them for less, I'm sure. I personally have taken my child to the pediatrician for less.
Same. And, you know, all of this really sounds terrifying. Allison, you know, your role in educating people, teachers, coaches, school staff, what would you say for those that might interact with kids with type 1 diabetes?
They can do it. That is just to the point. They can do it. I think there is somewhat of a fear around type 1 diabetes and what that looks like for children to play sports. Can they be in theater? Can they be in the marching band? Can they march in the Rose Parade? Right? Like that is somewhere that you are walking a really long way and you're carrying your instrument and managing your blood sugar and managing hydration and food and all those things. Can they do it? And the answer, in short, is yes, absolutely. And that is the reason that we are here to provide that support to these kids, because I've been doing it for 30 years and there has been a lot of improvement in even the insulins that are out there, the technology that's out there. But just with the experience that we've had, I've helped someone, I spoke about the Rose Parade, figure out how he was going to be able to march with his marching band in the Rose Parade. We have helped kids figure out how to play sports at a collegiate level. And as we're children, we don't usually go much further than collegiate levels. But we've helped kids manage how they can be in a theater production that's hours long, where they're not getting a break. They're on stage the whole time. I was one of those people that was on stage. So we had to figure out, how can I manage my blood sugar for this period of time without needing a break? And listen, we always have that respect to say, if you need a break, you take your break. That's incredibly important in diabetes. In type 1 diabetes, it's important to know your limits. But my job and my goal is to make those limits a lot bigger and make it feel unlimited, so that whomever has type 1 diabetes or even type 2 diabetes is not limited by the disease, that we can figure out a pathway, whatever that looks like, for you to accomplish any of those goals. So coaches, teachers, friends, RAs, when you're going to college, new people that you see in the street, they can do it. I think that one of the questions that I used to get growing up and even still get growing up is, can you have that? Can you do that?
Oh, yeah.
And it's, you're Megan Loving, you've gotten it too. I know. I think those questions are well-intentioned. I don't think anyone really looks at me and says, she's incapable. It is a, I want to help you. Can you do that? Explain to me why you can or can't do that. And just have them talk with their trusted professional or their mom or a friend with diabetes. And that's one of the really wonderful things about the type 1 diabetes community, is that it is a community. I don't necessarily want to welcome anyone new, but once you're here, you're in. And we want to provide hope and empowerment and education so that you can accomplish anything that you want.
And real quick, you mentioned technology has evolved in the last 30 years since you were diagnosed. What would you say, and how would you say technology has evolved to help type 1 patients?
So when I was diagnosed 30 years ago, I was not even on the types of insulin that we have now. I was on an NPH and regular insulin. When I was checking my blood sugar, we had to get these huge drops of blood onto a meter, and it would take 30 seconds or a minute to get a blood sugar. And we're taking multiple injections a day. The insulin pumps that were out at that time were huge, and they wouldn't do any calculations. And so as time has evolved, those meters got smaller. The amount of blood needed was a lot less. The insulins changed. We got insulins that had more rapid onset than regular. We had a Humalog. We now even have faster acting insulins than those. And from the meter perspective, now we have what's called continuous glucose monitors. And those are monitoring your blood sugar constantly and telling you where the blood sugar is going to go. Is it going up? Is it coming down? And what that's going to look like in 5 minutes and what it looked like 10 minutes ago. As the monitoring has improved with technology, so have our insulin pumps. And now insulin pumps very recently have, and when I say recently for diabetes, that's within the last 5-ish years, become automated. So they're taking that glucose that the sensor is reading and making insulin decisions. So they're increasing your insulin, they're decreasing your insulin. They're really helping you manage that glucose. It's not magic. I wish it was. There are still things that we have to do to monitor. We have to make sure that that insulin pump is connected properly. We're still entering glucose into the insulin pump. We are still managing things, but it can really help on the back end with low blood sugars and high blood sugars. To Megan's point, just being respectful of the disease, knowing that there are things that we have to do, but that we do have some wonderful safety nets that have come from technology.
Yeah. And it can be so encouraging thinking, okay, what's the new technology that's going to come out that's going to be even better? Dr. Nichols, I just want to get a few technical things, like what happens when glucose gets too low or too high?
When glucose gets too low, the fancy word for that is hypoglycemia. And that is the true fuel for the brain. The brain cannot use other types of energy. So the rest of the body can use the breakdown of fat. The brain needs sugar. So when blood sugar gets less than 50, 40, God forbid 30, you can start to see central nervous system effects, which can include passing out, having a seizure. Those would be the big bad scaries. If you notice a blood sugar dropping, if you are someone with diabetes and you notice a blood sugar dropping, the first and best thing to do is give sugar. So that usually comes in the form of juice or glucose tabs, whatever your choice is. And that's something that someone with type 1 diabetes needs to always have on their person or with a trusted adult who is with them. That's something that always needs to be around. The worst case scenario is that they have to use a medicine, a rescue medicine called glucagon. And that is sort of like the epinephrine or EpiPen equivalent for someone with type 1 diabetes. And that's an injection medicine that's a reversal of insulin.
This has been so informative and just really powerful that so many things that we didn't understand about type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Is there anything, Allison, as a voice, a diabetes educator, that you want listeners to remember?
I think it goes back to the you can do it. This is why I do my job. Let us help you do it, whatever that looks like. You can do it. Be sure you have, like Dr. Nichols said, a healthy respect for the condition. Have your glucose tablets, have your juice ready if you need it. Be sure you're taking your insulin, but you can do it. And I think that my voice, I hope, is one of empowerment and education to be able to accomplish anything that you want to accomplish for someone with type 1.
And do you have quick advice for parents in the community, like room moms, team moms, any ways they can be a champion for type 1 families?
Well, I would just echo sort of what Megan told us that Sarah said. I wish people would just ask me rather than, if you don't know what it is, don't make assumptions. Don't say, oh, I know someone with type 2, or, oh, I've kind of heard of diabetes. Ask somebody what they can do. But it's more in an open-ended, I want to be here to support you. What do you need to make that happen?
We had a really pleasant surprise along those lines. My daughter is still MDI, which stands for manual daily injections. A lot of doctors, understandably, will prefer to wait to introduce a pump. And this was our choice as well, until at least 6 months, if not a year, as the patients are working through their honeymoon phase. Because a lot of patients, when they're diagnosed, the pancreas might not be completely non-functional. And so something that we learned was you do your best to figure out your ratios and to dose accordingly. But the pancreas might wake up at 2 a.m. and decide to squirt a little insulin into your system. And then all of a sudden your numbers are crashing. And so we got a phone call in the spring from the director of our marching band, who has taught hundreds of children, surprisingly none with type 1, who proactively went to our county's cluster nurse, who offered him a 3-hour training session so that he would be better informed, more aware, more perceptive, could better communicate with the other parents. So it wasn't just me or me and my daughter or me, my daughter and my husband. She goes on overnight trips with the band. She's in national competitions. That really was phenomenal. Similarly, when you're in a high school, we had some challenges, and I say this to other parents, where she would have to do injections newly after diagnosis and go to the clinic. Well, this was the middle of the winter. Who usually goes to the clinic? Kids when they're sick, right? And so a flu or a stomach virus for a type 1 patient can have far more adverse outcomes. And so I would encourage parents to sit down with your administrators, your extracurricular chaperones, whatever, and create a 504 plan. And in doing that, you can work collaboratively to figure out how can we as a community best support this child? And in the situation of Sarah, they were willing to dedicate one of the staff restrooms for her to do her injections so that she wasn't putting herself in increased risk of getting a virus or a stomach flu doing it in the clinic. There are ways that you can work with other adults, with coaches, with nurses, with administrators, but never be afraid to advocate for your child. And I think that's made a huge difference in terms of how she's doing mentally and how we're kind of just powering through this.
I think that's a really great point that you bring up in finding, you were talking about coaches and teachers, but even just finding community in diabetes, I think that can be so key in figuring out what looks best for you. Finding other people who have gone through this before you and that know and have been there, have been in your high school, have been in your middle school, to find those people and have those conversations. And I think one additional plug for children's in the diabetes education program, we also offer caregiver classes that are completely free and open to the public. So
wonderful.
If you do know someone with diabetes and you want to learn more, we have, it's a 3-4 hour class for anyone. And you can sign up right through the children's website to learn more about diabetes, how to manage it, what that looks like, what to do for high and low blood sugar. So I think that's a really great point.
Yeah. And as we enter into the cold and flu season, it's like that reminder, keep your kids home if they're sick, because as Megan pointed out, they're more vulnerable to these types of viruses. And so think about that. Think about these families in your communities. Dr. Nichols, as we wrap up the episode, I just want to get an idea from you. For someone that has a thirsty kid who's peeing a lot, what are the key differences that you need to be watching for so that you don't go into panic mode?
Type 1 diabetes only progresses until it gets diagnosed. So I would say keep a close eye on it and trust your parental instincts. And when you are truly worried, do not hesitate to contact your pediatrician, because that's what they're there for. There is a research consortium called TrialNet that is a national screening for people who are at risk for type 1 diabetes. It's free testing, free screening, free follow-up, and plugs you into also the resources so that if you actually have a true hereditary risk, you can look for trialnet.org.
This has been such an informative episode. And thank you, Allison and Megan, for sharing your personal journey with us. And then, of course, Allison, your professional, Dr. Nichols, all of your knowledge. It's been so helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks so much.
For more type 1 diabetes resources, head to choa.org/podcasts. That's choa.org/podcasts, where we're going to link to a bunch of helpful resources and articles about diabetes. This has been Hope and Will, a parenting podcast from Children's Healthcare of Atlanta.
This podcast is for general informational and educational purposes only. It is not to be considered medical advice for any particular patient. Clinicians must rely on their own informed clinical judgments when making recommendations for their patients. Patients in need of medical or behavioral advice should consult their family healthcare providers.